From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made across the street from where the Constitution was written. 8 years ago, Senator Barack Obama delivered that now famous address on race called A More Perfect Union. And this hour, we continue our review of the speech and our discussion of where our country has gone in the intervening 8 years. Last hour, we heard from elected leaders in various capacities. This hour, we talked to members of our community who are working in their own ways to affect change here. And let me welcome my guests now. Danielle Ponder is a criminal defense attorney and lead singer of Danielle Ponder and the Tomorrow People. And I think even more popular for your stage work than you are for your criminal defense work. But that just says a lot about...
Yeah, definitely.
Nice to see you here. Thank you for being here. Sean Brown's a program coordinator for Teen Empowerment. Sean, nice to have you.
Evan, thanks for having me back, my friend.
Dwayne Mahoney is executive director of the Boys and Girls Club of Rochester. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you, Evan.
And Virtus Robinson, professor of history and African American studies at Monroe Community College. Virtus, welcome back to you.
Always a pleasure.
All right, Virtus, the educator in you, I want to know what you take from that speech 8 years ago to now. But before we dive right in there, let's listen to some more of the president's comments. And again, then Senator Obama's comments. 8 years ago today, he was preparing to give those remarks in Philadelphia. And I want to talk about what he had to say about the concentration of poverty at the time. This is what Barack Obama said in 2008, obviously hoping that we could sit here 8 years later and talk about at least some progress. Here was him in 2008.
Legalized discrimination, where blacks were prevented, often through violence, from owning property, or loans were not granted to African-American business owners, or black homeowners could not access FHA mortgages, or blacks were excluded from unions or the police force or the fire department, meant that black families could not amass any meaningful wealth to bequeath to future generations. That history helps explain the wealth and income gap between blacks and whites and the concentrated pockets of poverty that persist in so many of today's urban and rural communities.
I know 8 years, Virtus, isn't always enough time to affect a whole lot of change, but has there been any change meaningfully in that way in 8 years?
Well, there has been change, and the change that I'm kind of working on right now is the fact that 8 years ago we were still under the PC era, where everyone was where racism was in private sectors. It was in private homes, and you did not say anything. And you made sure you didn't, and then there was quotas and things of that nature. Now people are being outward with it, and an unapologetically racist, and saying I'm not racist at the same time. So I mean, and we see that in how the current president, President Barack Obama, has been treated in the past 8 years, and outwardly, I mean, you see that. I mean, even from his first State of the Union address, when people were sleeping. I mean, how can you sleep within the first 15 minutes of a presidential address? And the cameras were right on the people that were sleeping instead of on. So even with that, 8 years ago, let me be personal, if you don't mind. 8 years ago, I was not a registered voter. Even though I was a history professor, I was not a registered voter because I believe that my vote didn't count. I believe that the country would do whatever they're going to do and want to do. And even without being a productive member of society. So I was not a registered voter until I heard this speech, this very speech right here, and it spoke to me. It spoke to me. Even that part right there spoke to me, and also my personal history. And after hearing this speech, I start listening to what other people were saying. I start listening to what the other side was saying. I was starting to educate myself. I registered the vote. And also, I brought that into my classroom. And a lot of my students became first-time registered voters as well, including someone that was 65 years old. And we all voted for the first time that year.
But now, are you feeling, do your views of the speech change at all? In any way, given what's happened over 8 years, you know, progress or lack of progress.
And again, because I was listening to the first half, and that's kind of hard to say, because then we have to measure what progress is. There have been progress, but can this speech be said today and it still be valid. Absolutely. And so what is that progress? I don't think so. Not in the way that we should go, but at least our eyes are starting to open up a lot more than 8 years ago. And I mean, and this speech woke me up. So I'm waiting for another speech or maybe my own speech to come out so that we can really impact change. And that's what he wanted to do 8 years ago.
All right. Let me go around the table and ask kind of what stood out to our various panelists about some of the elements that then-Senator Obama was talking about 8 years ago and what we see today. And Danielle Ponder, we closed the last hour. Toward the end, we had a listener question for former Police Chief Jim Shepard about community relations, police relations, the way African-Americans are treated in the courts, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And one of our listeners was saying they think it is worse in 2016 than it was when then-candidate Obama was talking about these issues in 2008. What do you see?
I'm not sure if it's worse or is it more that we just have more access to social media, so we see these things going on throughout the community. I mean, being able to see African-American men killed on a YouTube video all over Twitter or Instagram or Facebook is something I don't think we were seeing as frequently in 2008. Do I think there has been deep systemic changes since this speech? Absolutely not. Do I think there has been encouraging conversations? Yes. I think that President Obama talking about racism within the criminal justice system is something that I've never seen before. Even the Democratic candidates now talking about racial disparities in criminal justice system. So I am hopeful that we're having conversations. I think there's more white people talking about white privilege and okay saying that word. Even I remember you had a show and there was a conversation about white privilege. I didn't think I would kind of hear those words, you know, in mainstream media. But yes, I do think we have a long way to go. I will say that the way I received this speech after reviewing it yesterday was much different than I received it when I was on my way into law school in 2008. And that is because I realized the reason why he gave this speech, and this may be, you know, different from what everyone else feels, but he gave this speech because Jeremiah Wright, what happened with Jeremiah Wright and a lot of the flack that he was giving. This speech, in my opinion, was really about comforting white fears that they had with Barack Obama. Obama didn't say anything in that speech that black people didn't already know. This was really a speech for white people. And the reason why that's problematic, and I looked at this speech more critically, is because white thoughts and white feelings and white lives have more value in this country. Hillary Clinton just recently, there was a protester who talked about her support of the crime bill under Bill Clinton and her referring to encoded language black youth as super predators. Yeah. Hillary Clinton did not have to give a speech about that because the offended population were black people. All she had to do was send out a tweet saying, yeah, I shouldn't have said that. But Barack Obama had to do a 40-minute speech to say, you know, I'm not like him. I'm not like the rest of them. You can trust me. And a lot of things that he said in that speech, I won't keep rambling, but were problematic. But that was the kind of the critical analysis that I looked at this speech in.
And you know, we can't psychoanalyze the president, but I will say this. First of all, I think that's a very interesting framing, because you're right. Hillary Clinton tweeted, you know, wish we hadn't said super predators, but times have changed. I see it differently. And you're right. I think the president had to give that speech at that moment in his campaign, in some ways, to save the campaign. Mm-hmm. But he did, I think, also, Danielle, he did say, yes, do I disagree with Jeremiah Wright about goddamn America and things of that nature? Yes. But he also said, I can't disavow him any more than I would disavow my own family. And many of those comments were in the context of understanding history. Yeah. A history of which there has been inequality and frustration and anger. And that, I think, did open a door for him to speak to. You're right. He was speaking to a white audience that might have been uncomfortable with Jeremiah Wright. But he chose that moment to not say, throw that guy under the bus and I'm done with him. Mm-hmm. I think he tried to say, you may not know the history. Right. You may not know the context. And that at least maybe wasn't as far as some people wanted. But it's still never really been done before.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
I appreciated him, you know, him talking about the inability to get housing loans or the inability to be part of a union. I appreciated him bringing that into the national spotlight, because I think that's the foundation of which, you know, poverty is built on in the Black community, and we don't have that conversation. So definitely there are great things about this speech. But I'm really, when I'm thinking about how we make a difference, I'm looking more critically at things than I've ever done before, right? So there's another part of this speech that is saying Jeremiah Wright was bitter. And he was bitter because his, you know, grandparents were lynched and they were enslaved and Jim Crow. And he was bitter, and we can understand that. But white people are also bitter because they have the irrational thought that Black people are taking their jobs. You can't compare the two. I mean,
well, just because Danielle brings it up, white resentment. That was the theme of the speech. Let's listen to what the president said about that. This is the section of that speech in 2008 in which then-Senator Obama talked about what white Americans might have been feeling.
Most working and middle-class white Americans don't feel that they've been particularly privileged by their race. Their experience is the immigrant experience. As far as they're concerned, no one handed them anything. They've built it from scratch. They've worked hard all their lives, many times only to see their jobs shipped overseas or their pensions dumped after a lifetime of labor. They are anxious about their futures, and they feel their dreams slipping away. And in an era of stagnant wages and global competition, opportunity comes to be seen as a zero-sum game in which your dreams come at my expense. So when they are told to bus their children to a school across town, when they hear an African American is getting an advantage in landing a good job or a spot in a good college because of an injustice that they themselves never committed, when they're told that their fears about crime in urban neighborhoods are somehow prejudice, resentment builds over time. And just as Black anger often proved counterproductive, so have these white resentments distracted attention from the real culprits of the middle class squeeze, a corporate culture rife with inside dealing, questionable accounting practices, and short-term greed, a Washington dominated by lobbyists and special interests, economic policies that favor the few over the many. And yet, to wish away the resentments of white Americans, to label them as misguided or even racist, without recognizing they are grounded in legitimate concerns, this too widens the racial divide and blocks the path to understanding.
Danielle, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, they're grounded in legitimate concerns. They're grounded in fear and in irrational fear, and it's based on absolutely no facts. But I do think the part of healing, there has to be an acknowledgement of what you currently feel, even if your fear is completely irrational. So I can respect that he acknowledged what they're currently feeling, that, you know, whether it's Black people are taking their jobs or Mexicans are taking their jobs or whatever it is, people are seeking, I think poor white people seek power. And one of their ways of obtaining that power is to embrace white supremacy, because that gives them a feeling of power. But I just don't like this juxtaposition of Black anger, which has never done anything systemically to white people, and white resentment, which has. No matter how angry Black people are, it has not changed the daily lives of white people. But white resentment has resulted in a biased criminal justice system. It has resulted in a welfare system where Black women are more likely to get sanctioned. It has resulted in a healthcare industry where Black people are less likely to get pain medication. These feelings and stereotypes about Black people have actually resulted in systemic issues, and no amount of Black anger has affected the daily lives of white people.
Let me just say on Twitter, Misty says, that speech was to comfort white people? Yikes. Of course it was, Misty. I mean, this was the presidential campaign. The news media started playing tapes of Jeremiah Wright. His poll numbers were starting to get shaky. And of course, he wanted voters, specifically white voters, who were uncomfortable. I mean, I don't think that's controversial. I mean, I think the president himself would say that he took that opportunity to address the country. He wasn't just talking to white voters, but of course, I don't think that's controversial. Sean Brown, so when you look at the speech, what stands out to you in 8 years? And by the way, let me just peel back a little bit and say, your work with Teen Empowerment. What's a quick snapshot for the audience of what you do with Teen Empowerment?
Basically, we're a youth organization. We hire young people to be youth organizers. We're a neighborhood-based program. We're on Genesee Street in Arnett. And those young people address the issues that young people face and kind of organize initiatives and events, lobby politicians, school board members, work with their peers one-on-one to really bring about some change and try to move the systemic issues that kind of oppress black and brown youth in the city of Rochester.
All right, we're going back to 8 years ago in the campaign and all of these comments from then-Senator Obama. Compare them to now. What stands out to you?
I kind of agree with the first two folks that spoke. It's kind of hard to really gauge change. But I guess if you're black living in America and you live in inner cities and urban environments around the country, I don't think we've seen the progress or the change. I definitely feel like young people still go to schools that are drastically different than suburban districts with the resources and opportunities they're given. We still see the housing. We still see the healthcare crunch. So in a lot of ways, I think, you know, Senator Obama at the time brought up the issues. And I think the Reverend Wright distraction was just that, a distraction to kind of take folks away from the issues. And if you look at the presidential campaigns on both parties right now, I think, again, we focus too much on the distractions and the stuff that's not really getting us away from issues. How are we going to address poverty? You know, can we use some of that $690 billion to kind of like stimulate stuff in America and change urban environments? But those things really get talked about. It's, you know, the Trumpster being the Trumpster.
If you could go back to 2008 and talk to Sean Brown 2008, the day after this speech, and then say, this man's going to get elected twice, and then you'll be able to see where, especially in your work with Teen Empowerment, just as an example, and working with kids in this community, working with people in this community, would you have said, yes, that 8 years isn't going to change everything, but we are on the right track, we've made progress, or would you be surprised at where we are now?
I guess I was surprised that Obama got elected the first time. I was surprised that he got elected the second time. I voted for him both times, and not based on the color of his skin, but I felt like the platform and the direction he was trying to take the country, I thought was revolutionary and really trying to do something different. And if those things worked or failed, I feel like the attempt and the want and the focus on a different America was the thing that I supported. Like Virta said, I think that definitely sparked a lot of black and brown youth and youth in general to really kind of get involved in politics. I think when you have someone that looks like you, reflects your family and where you come from running for the highest office in the world, I think that's definitely going to spark your interest in politics and the political system here at home. But again, changes I see, I don't know. I think that's very, very hard to gauge. I just know young people are thirsty to be heard, thirsty to let their voices be noticed and have power in their actions, and I think be supported by the world, society, and the laws that govern us.
All right, Dwayne Mahoney, compare 8 years ago to now, and from your perspective, what stands out?
I think, well, for me, the speech cast, for me, a light on the president, and what I took from it was that here's a person that, given his background and from where his parents, grandparents, that he really is representative, probably than more than anybody, of representative of a diverse America. And that's kind of what I took from the speech, that, you know, it did, you know, obviously it was to quell the, you know, the things that went on with Reverend Wright, but I think it took on a different life of its own in the sense of, He came off as all things to all. His background represents all things to all people. So, when you have a Reverend Wright or somebody like that, you know, we all have people that we know that are that maybe they say something that you don't agree with, but there are, you know, 20 other qualities that, you know, the fact that Reverend Wright was in the Marine Corps, you know, those kind of things, and what he does for poor people. You know, I think that those are the things that I took away from, is that there we can't be judgmental in the sense of judging the president on that, because the same people that are criticizing him at that time also have people that they know that fall into that same category, and you go, hey, I don't appreciate what you said. It just doesn't happen to be very public. I think you know, if you look at the presidential race right now, and if you put President Obama as a candidate in Donald Trump's shoes, I can't even imagine what the backlash would be if he said the same things that, you know, that candidate Trump is saying right now. Is there progress? To me, it depends on where you want to come into the conversation. Yes, there's progress in certain areas, but there's not progress in some of the major areas that are going to move people out of poverty. And it's not just African Americans. That's it's Latinos. It's poor whites. There are, I think, for the black experience, it's, you know, I can, when you talked, when you read the, when you played the clip about middle class, having that immigrant experience, you know, my I feel like when I it took me back to when I grew up. My parents were the first born in the United States. My my parents are both from the West Indies, and they had a similar view in terms of how hard they felt like they worked to get here, and then when they got here, how, you know, they didn't want things handed to them. And I don't think I think the more they were here, the more they understood that it's not about handing things to people. It's helping people who need that push, or who need just that extra to get them to be self-sufficient. I mean, this, you know, there's this sometimes this and I see it a lot with the parents that come into the Boys and Girls Club, you know, this where people think that some of the parents that we serve don't want to be self-sufficient, don't want to work hard. They do. They want the same. They want the same breaks and opportunities that everyone else might get. You know, last summer there was a local business person who called us and said, "You know what? I'd like to offer 2 paid internships to 2 of your kids, you know, that are in college." So it wasn't hard for us to find 2 kids to take those internships. And the way that he phrased it was, "I give these out like candy to some of my friends, to their friends. They'll call up and say, 'Hey, here's a paid internship at my firm. If your son or daughter wants it.'" You know, we don't have access to that. And it you know, you have to applaud him for doing that. But it has to be scaled. You know, the thing with the speech was, to me, is it's a speech. You know, there was no, it's like having a great strategic plan, but no metrics underneath the plan to actually implement anything of it, you know. So if you hear the speech and, you know, 10 days later, you're not sitting there going, "Well, you know, I'm gonna really live my life off of this speech." You know, there's not some nationwide action-oriented movement. So I don't know why people would be looking for that speech to inspire a whole nationwide progress. You know, there are kernels of things here and there's regression here. It's almost like, mm-hmm. you know, there are a number of different meters where things are getting better here, but they're getting progressively sure. worse here.
Well, Virtus, you love the speech, but a little bit of a sterner critique there from Dwayne. What would you say to that?
Well, I understand where you're coming from, absolutely. And it... And as we were saying, we have to understand the context for the speech. And for me, it was a great history lesson that you never really heard a presidential candidate or anyone of that stature actually saying about the history of this country. He started off with, you know, 1776, or, you know, at the beginning of this country, and our forefathers came together in a room in Philadelphia. But then he added slavery right away when he was talking about the Constitution being written and how slavery basically was the greatest contradiction to American liberty. That's how I teach it, but that's not how I was taught it. I was taught it, this country was founded on the principles that everyone is free and open for their own opinions, and everyone has a right to that American dream. When I was growing up, I didn't see that American dream and until, guess what, I was bused to the suburbs where I saw the American dream. So, I mean, I understand where he was coming from and how he brought himself into there. He brought his story, his background, his past. And also he brought in the critiques that he was hearing, that he wasn't black enough, that he wasn't white enough, and that's what he struggled with growing up. So bringing that to the forefront and bringing African Americans back into American history and also bringing that to a national platform was significant in my book.
All right, I'm late for a break. One quick question for the panel, because I've said on this program yesterday, I'm going to keep saying this, and I hope soon we can have a panel of Donald Trump supporters on this program just so I can listen. I want to listen. I don't want to be condescending. I don't want to be judgmental. I want to understand as best I can. All right, and so I'm going to do my best to do a better job of just listening. But I think it's also important for people, if you're listening, if you support Donald Trump, the people in this room, I'm just going to ask you a quick question, because Michelle Norris said on this program yesterday, a lot of people in the African-American community hear the phrase, make America great again, and there is racial coding. Maybe not of every Trump supporter, but there is a racial code to it. Yes or no?
Absolutely. I think even the comments that he makes, that in the good old days, we would handle that person like this. The person he's talking about handling is a person of color that got kicked out of one of his protests. So
That's true.
You say, as a white man, like, we're going to take care of them like we did the good old days, that only has one connotation. That means lynching. That means death. That means extreme discrimination and hatred. So, yeah, I don't even think that's coded. I think that's pretty blatant.
Okay. Anybody disagree? Does anybody not hear racial coding?
I don't disagree, but I didn't take it that way. But
okay.
What my issue with it is, you know, I don't take that one context of what he said. I have to also put some of the other things that I've heard him say, you know, building a wall, you know, punching people out. When you start to put those things together along with, you know, so you put the man behind that phrase, then you start seeing them a little differently. So if you take the phrase just by itself, it could mean that, you know, you want jobs to come back into the U.S. You want, you know, better prosperity for everybody. But when you start to, you know, build all the other things that you hear that surprisingly people apparently, because they're voting, they're voting with their, you know, with their, you know, I don't know what this percentage is, but it's, you know, he's leading the party. You wonder, you know, who those people are, and like you said, why they like that, and what does that mean? I'm more concerned about those kind of mm-hmm. phrases than the phrase that
okay.
you mentioned.
So, racial tones to that, Danielle?
I agree with him. I'm not so concerned about Make America Great Again. It's everything that came after that. I mean, he's been deliberately racist. We don't even have to look at coded language. He's said racist things, period.
Well, and I agree with that. It may not be so racial in a way, but I was just at the Barnes & Noble, and I saw this book that said that the nine worst president, or the nine presidents that destroyed America, and Obama was listed as the ninth one. He's not even done yet. So I'm like, destroyed America? So this whole fear that we got to take it back because America is broken, America is destroyed, and we're going to make it back, I mean, Oh, I'm not going to say it. So it reminds me, as a student of history, of someone else who said that. So, and I won't go there.
Let me go to break. and as I go to break, let me read an email from a listener named Dan, who actually emailed yesterday after we had that conversation with Michelle Norris about why a number of white working class voters bristle when you talk about the term white privilege. They say, where's my white privilege? I'm struggling. Jobs are gone. Manufacturing's gone. It's harder than ever. And Dan writes to us and says, the largely white middle class has been fading steadily, if it's not already gone. Of course, these people feel there's a bias against them. They have got it bad. They just need to be able to empathize with those who've got it even worse for a number of reasons. Much love in this discussion. That's mm-hmm. Dan's point. So, I actually thought that was a beautiful comment, because it's a reminder that, you know, it's not just a racial divide, that if you're an African American or if you're a white person, it's automatically life is going to be this or that.
Mm-hmm.
It just means there we all have different circumstances. And I think Dan's email was, there was some beauty to it. Let's get a short break, get your phone calls in, and we'll come back with our panel talking about 8 years since Senator Obama's speech on race in Philadelphia. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connection, first hour, it's our monthly edition of Unleashed, the pet show, taking your questions and comments for veterinarians, questions about your pet's answer, first hour. Then second hour, using art, using music, to help bring attention to the problem of child mortality in Rochester. We'll talk with you Friday on Connections.
The fight over Confederate symbols in the Old South is heating up in Mississippi. A new federal lawsuit says the state flag is unconstitutional.
The flag with that emblem is a vestige of slavery.
Take it down! Take it down!
When you're asking me to take it down because those people were so bad, those people were my ancestors.
Heritage or hate? Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI. 8 years ago, Senator Barack Obama made that address in Philadelphia called A More Perfect Union, in which he addressed his pastor, Reverend Jeremiah Wright, race in America, his faith, and the future of our country. And 8 years later, we are talking about where our community has gone in many different ways when it comes to how we are getting along, either healing or not, et cetera. And our panel is here from various parts of our community. Dwayne Mahoney, Executive Director of the Boys and Girls Club of Rochester. Virtus Robinson, a professor of history and African-American studies at Monroe Community College. Danielle Ponder, a criminal defense attorney. And by the way, the lead singer of Danielle Ponder and the Tomorrow People. Sean Brown, the program coordinator for Teen Empowerment. And to your phones we go, and let me grab Ken first up. Ken's in Irondequoit. Go ahead, Ken.
Yeah, hi, Evan. I just wanted to say I really enjoyed the comments of the first segment about the More Perfect Union speech. And Danielle hit the nail on the head when she said that basically the speech was to placate the white population, which was true. Little inside information, when all of this came up with Reverend Jeremiah Wright, the campaign didn't want candidate Obama to respond to it, but he personally felt that this was an opportunity to give him a chance to address the race issue. As time went on and the little scuttlebutt that went back and forth, Jeremiah Wright was asked to speak at a number of places, the Press Radio Club in D.C., and he also spoke here at a church. We had thought as a campaign that this would blow over. And in the end, we had to throw Reverend Wright under the bus because he was persistent about talking about race. We needed the entire population of the country to vote for candidate Obama. And race was something that we really didn't like to deal with, because this was a political campaign, you know, for our candidate. Let me just give one quick fact that one of our volunteers, this was before the speech, and it really took me aback when that volunteer and that volunteer's mother had came over to my house after they were going out, giving out literature for the campaign, that they came to a house here in Irondequoit, and the person who lived there said, "I am not going to sign anything for that N-word." Mm. And the volunteer was a student in high school, and she broke down and lost it. And there are a number of racial negativity here in the Rochester area during that campaign, of which I didn't speak about and still don't want to speak about it. Just wanted to use that one example. Well, so it's great here in the panel, and you guys are doing a great job.
Ken, thanks for the phone call. I appreciate that. Just some perspective there from Ken Preston, again, who was a local chair for the Obama campaign and so involved there. Let me get to, before I get back to the phones, here's an email from a listener named Dennis, different perspective. And I think he's talking about Danielle when he says, regarding the young lady's wholesale discounting of the phrase white backlash being totally unfounded, I, a middle-class male white professional, trying to support my family as best I can, in my career have twice been moved out of a current, well-performing job, and multiple times have been disallowed from applying for advanced positions explicitly because of my race and gender as a white male. Have any of your panel members been given in writing refusal of application explicitly because of their race and or gender? From Dennis. Danielle?
Oh, wow, Dennis, I'm sorry that's happened to him. I don't know anything about Dennis' story. I don't know anything about that. I've never heard that happening to someone. If that did happen to him, I'm sorry to hear that. I only can speak to what we know statistically is going on as far as the black unemployment rate being twice the white unemployment rate, the black poverty rate being higher, the incarceration rate being higher. So while I appreciate, you know, his qualitative data, there's actually quantitative data that suggests that blacks are faring unequally. And I think that's, you know, this is so personal that it's sometimes hard for people to, if you've had that experience, to actually say, well, let me look at the statistics and see if this is really happening everywhere. Is this just me? Because this is something that has happened to him. And so there's some pain and frustration that comes from that. Is that, though, the experience of the majority of white people in America? I think I'd have to say no.
Well, I think we know it's not. And I also don't know the emailer, and I don't want to denigrate at all his story. And certainly I think we all want to succeed. We all want to work hard and do well. But, I mean, if somebody came to me tomorrow and said, Evan, I know you've been working hard at WXXI, but because of your race, we're taking you out of the job. You know what I would probably have to do? I'd probably have to realize that that's tough for me, but the history of our country, and again, this probably wouldn't happen, but the bottom line is I don't think I could look at the history of the country and feel nearly as aggrieved in any sense or fashion, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Virtus, so you have a strange look on your face. What do you think?
Well, I would say that if he had that in writing, like you don't have this job because you are white and that you're a male.
Yeah.
If he had that in writing, you know, getting back to the first half, I mean, I think he should go to Van White and as a civil rights attorney.
Sure.
Because it's illegal.
Right.
So, but I mean, if it's there in black and white, then that's illegal. Even if it says because you're white, it is illegal. But the reason why I was smirking like that is because it reminds me of, I think it was like one of the shows, maybe it was like All in the Family or something like that. And the son was passed up because there was a black candidate, and it was during a time of affirmative action, we're in the early 70s. And so he sat the white son down, the white boss, and said, you know, we've had this history. And we know that, yes, you've been passed up, but they've been passed up for 200 years. And so that's why I was smirking like that, because I remember, you know, watching this as a child and saying, you know, but is that right or is that wrong? You know what? I love Ta-Nehisi Coates with his case for reparations. Hey, I'm with it.
Okay. let me get back to the phones now. Bill and Webster is next up. Go ahead, Bill.
Good show, good discussion.
Thanks, Bill.
My political preferences, I'm white, I'm 50. I am Republican, I am intending on voting Democratic this year. The last four or five shows you've had on, Evan, every one of your panelists have brought up the Trumpster, I like the term, is going to build a wall. Well, interesting, I did some fact-finding. That wall has already been appropriated by a United States Senate Appropriations Committee and approved for financing long before the Trumpster came along. So when we take statistics about segregation, our minorities, if we start stacking on the mistruths, then we add to the error of our statistic analysis and makes it a false statement. So there's been a wall in plan for a long time, but it's already been funded by both parties. So everyone's taking a false statement and continuing it on. So I just wanted to express that. I'll go back to listening.
All right. Well, Bill, thanks. First of all, Bill, thanks for the phone call. And I don't know exactly the bill or whatever the appropriation he's talking about. But even if that's the case, I would just say, Bill, nobody is speaking about the wall with the excitement of Donald Trump, with the enthusiasm of Donald Trump, and with the applause lines that come from, well, we'll just build it 10 feet higher than Donald Trump. And remember, it all goes back to June of last year when he launched his campaign. Within minutes of launching his campaign, was talking about Mexicans as being rapists and drug addicts, in very general terms. So, but I mean, maybe Bill's right. Maybe there's an appropriation already in place for the wall. It's just, I think it's the vigor of the message that I have seen. I don't know if any of the panelists feel differently.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with you know, even assuming this is true, that there's this appropriation, I've heard Donald Trump saying that he's going to get Mexico to pay for the wall. So, you know, in one instance is an appropriation, in the next instance he's going to get somebody else to pay for it.
Sure.
But it's not that. It's nothing wrong with saying you want to, you know, protect your borders and you want to, you know, make a safer America for whatever reason, or make it fair for everybody to get in the proper way. But you don't have to go out and call people what he's called people, because, you know, we have to work with all these countries. And I can't understand how, you know, you're going to have a president that is, you know, alienated or wants to alienate so many different groups and still be be diverse enough to work together. So I don't think it's necessarily the wall. It's about what he says around it.
John?
I mean, I think that rhetoric you just spoke of talking about Mexicans being murderers and rapists, I mean, I think as black folks in America, we know that rhetoric. You know, I think that's been used to make white people afraid of us, to criminalize black people. And a lot of times that's come from elected public officials that says these things, that send fear out in white America. They get laws and different interactions changed and compromised by those words. And I think that's the danger.
Yeah. Let me get back to the phones. And this is John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Listen, you know, I grew up in the 50s and 60s. And I saw a lot of racism growing up in Buffalo, overt racism. But I have to say, I think the president has been a divider since he's been in office. And I can tell you where he could have really helped himself. As one example, in the Ferguson situation with Michael Brown, who was shown on tape, et cetera, to be a criminal, and was shown to the grand jury that he was the aggressor and this police officer was fighting for his life. There was a situation, if the president would have looked at those facts and maybe given a speech about that incident, I think the white culture in this country would have said, all right, he's acknowledged in this specific case that this Michael Brown was a criminal and was at fault. Now, having said that, you had the case with Eric Garner. Now, that's a whole different situation. Of course, the South Carolina shooting.
Walter Scott, yes.
Exactly. Now, that the white culture, the white populace in this country would recognize that. But when he did not come out and in certain instances kind of defended Michael Brown to a certain extent, I really think that type of situation creates the division, and that's why we're in this situation today.
John, hold on. Stay on the line there. Danielle, you were the first to react. Go ahead, Danielle.
Well,
Danielle Ponder, by the way, is a criminal defense attorney. Go ahead, Danielle.
Wow. You know, so even if Michael Brown was a criminal, does that mean we execute people who allegedly have committed crimes, or even if he did commit a crime? And I think at that time,
well, I just want to say, if I remember correctly, Danielle, the DOJ report itself, and I think Eric Holder was heading the DOJ when the report came out, they could not find evidence that the police officer was at fault in that shooting.
But I think what I'm saying is the caller's first response was, but he was a criminal. But he was a criminal.
He was. They had him on tape.
Right, but does that mean?
And he was. He had some illegal substances in his body. So, I think marijuana or something.
I guess my question is: so whatever he did, does that mean in this country we execute people in the middle of the street because they're criminals?
The police officer was defending himself. The police officer was fighting for his life. Michael Brown weighed almost 300 pounds and was 6'3". Or 6'4", I think maybe even bigger than that.
Was
fighting for his life. And that, to me, when you yourself it sounds like you're defending Michael Brown here, this is where you lose a lot of credibility versus an Eric Garner case or, you know, some of the case in Charleston. Now, if you defend Michael Brown, the white populace in this country,
are going to get upset over that. Because
yeah, I'm absolutely defending Michael Brown.
Me too.
Michael Brown.
And I'm absolutely defending Michael Brown, and I'm absolutely not concerned with the white populace that might be angry. And actually, I think there's a lot of white.
All right,
John,
now,
you gotta let Daniel.
President Obama has been a divider.
All right, John, thanks for the phone call. Go ahead, Daniel.
And I think there's a lot of white progressives, a lot of, you know, white progressives that I work with who are my friends that also are defending Michael Brown. And I think what was interesting about the grand jury testimony is I read that. And if you are a defense attorney or if you're a public defender and you've read police statements, that was a classic police statement. And we see it all the time. And often, whether it's I thought he was reaching for something or he looked like he was coming towards me. When I have a client who has a black eye and has clearly been beaten up by the police officer, these are common statements that are put into the police officer's paperwork. So we know it. We know that officers lie. And we know that me reading that statement, my opinion was that was not the truth. But the fact of the matter is, if he was indicted and brought to the grand jury, not as an officer, but as a black male, and he made that same statement, we would be looking at felony charges. I think there's a tendency to believe officers or give officers a pass, but cops lie every day, and they lie every day in Rochester City Court as well. But the thought that when our children are dying, our concern should be making white people feel better is completely asinine to me. I have no interest whatsoever in something like Michael Brown happening, thinking, well, you know, I don't want to make white people too angry. And the thought that what you're really saying when you say that President Obama was being divisive, President or by not addressing that issue or all these issues happening in Ferguson, what you're really saying is that he's making us uncomfortable. All of this is making us uncomfortable. We didn't have to think about police killings. We didn't have to think about what's going on in the inner city. And now we got to think about it. And that makes me uncomfortable. And that pulls me away from you. But for people, black people in this country, we've been knowing about police killings since we've been in this country. We've been knowing about what's happening in our community and the terrorizing of our community by police officers for hundreds of years. So this is not new for us. It's divisive to you because you've been able to be in a bubble. And in that bubble, you've been protected. And now you're taking out of it. And so the truth is, you're uncomfortable. So I think a big part of your healing would be first acknowledging that you're really uncomfortable with having to address issues you don't understand.
David writes on Twitter, not all white people agree with John. And Bill in Rochester wants to weigh on that as well. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, my question is to the gentleman who spoke about the shooting in Ferguson. I believe there was recently some Ku Klux Klan members that were shooting a shotgun from a car, and they're still alive. Now, how many black men, if they were shooting from a car at police, would still be alive today?
None.
That's my question, and that's where the problem lies. That's where white privilege falls in.
Bill,
and I'll let y'all discuss that.
Yeah, Bill, thanks for the phone call. Sean, you said none.
I guess I'm still thinking about the caller before Bill. He kept saying the first thing he said was Michael Brown was a criminal. And the last I checked, in the legal system in America, you're innocent until proven guilty. And I guess the thing that caller won't understand that when you're black in America, you're guilty until you're proven innocent. And so that whole different like shift in how like officers approach and look at us in those interactions make that interaction extremely dangerous and volatile for us and unpredictable in any circumstance. And again, it's like the common thing is that one black person does something wrong, kills someone, robs someone, and then the whole race of black people, now I become a murderer. Virtus becomes a murderer. Dwayne becomes a killer. But a white person blows up a building or does a mass shooting, that doesn't then apply that all white people are then violent and dangerous and capable of doing the same thing. And I feel like those are two distinct differences that I think is hard for a lot of white people to really grasp onto. And that's my feeling on this situation.
And Danielle, you know, last hour we had a former police chief, Jim Shepard, in. And I don't want to speak for Jim, but he did say, you know, he thinks that our community is working hard. The police department's working hard to improve relationships, to meet directly with people, to spend more time in communities, getting to know neighbors. that, and I don't know what he would say if he heard you say police officers lie every day, and I'm not here trying to push back against that. I know you're laughing because I know you're saying, look, it's cute that the white host is pushing back on this. I know. But I also know there are listeners who they get rattled when they hear that. So all I want to ask is this, because we're about to wrap the hour here. What can we do to make it better? We were talking about 8 years ago, the president's speech on race. What are we going to do to make that part of our community better?
So I think that what Chief Shepherd is saying is about, you know, as far as engaging in the community is happening. And I think it's important to say that just because there's officers lying doesn't mean I'm saying that every officer who gets on the stand and lies. There's some officers who are very credible and they're very honest. But I just think that we have to be real about what is happening. So if that statement is controversial for you when it's a fact, and I've seen it every day, then that's really a problem. I don't know what to tell you. But what we have to do to move forward is to have the uncomfortable conversations, to really be okay with hearing what the facts are, and to really get in the root to the root causes of what we're feeling. Like that last caller, he's leaving this with, you know, why did they, you know, condemn Michael Brown, as opposed to really looking inwardly and asking himself, where is that fear coming from for him? And where is that uncomfortableness coming from for him? So to me, we have to have the really difficult conversations. And I'll just say this last thing, because I think some of the callers, you know, we didn't really get like a progressive white opinion in a lot of these callers, but I'm a musician.
There's a good amount online that have been coming.
Yeah. And I perform in our last show, I'd say half of our audience was Black, white, Latino, old, young. We talk about the criminal justice system in our music. We talk about racism in our music. And we have a fan base that is completely diverse. So there is a movement of progressive people of all color who are getting it. And
her music, by the way, is, I mean, it is dope. I mean, like, there's a lot of people who love it. And so what is the website?
DanielPondermusic.com. And we have a new album out, Blow Out the Sun.
There you see. You can say that. Danielle, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
It's good to see you. And I know, like she said, it's not always comfortable conversations, but that's what it's about. Dwayne, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Sean Brown, great to see you from Teen Empowerment.
Always a pleasure.
And Virtus Robinson, thank you very much for being here as well.
And thank you.
We needed another hour. We needed about another 3 or 4 hours.
Yeah.
But listen, if you called today and couldn't get through, we had a ton of phone calls and comments online. The conversation continues, but we thought this day was an important day to mark that history. 8 years since President Obama's speech in Philadelphia. Thanks for all the interaction. Thank you to Valerie LaBanca, the engineer of the broadcast, Kate Cowie-Haskell, intern, Megan Mack, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great day.